point that when George Bush announced his candidacy, and even for several months after that, even though he was running against a not very well-known, sort of obscure and not very charismatic governor from Massachusetts, he was 15 to 20 points behind in the polls, and yet he ended up winning the election by a fairly sizable margin. And the reason for that is not because the country became convinced they were wrong and that Reaganomics and the Republican ideology was actually good for the country. The reason is because the people running George Bush's campaign, Roger Ailes and Lee Atwater, understood that there was no chance that they would win that election if the election were decided on anything having to do with substantive issues at all. And that the key to winning the election was to transform George Bush into this heroic, combative figure who challenged Dan Rather in an interview, who made all sorts of acrimonious and acerbic comments about winning debate, and more importantly, to completely destroy the character of Michael Dukakis, as someone who was this sort of awkward, nerdy loser who couldn't wear a helmet without looking like an imbecile, somebody who was sort of subversive by virtue of his card-carrying membership in the ACLU. And it worked. It worked perfectly, so that a Republican candidate at a time when the Republican Party was widely discredited and unpopular easily won that election against the credible Democrats. And ever since then, that same template has been used repeatedly and successfully by the Republican Party to win elections, even when their policy positions are vastly rejected by the American population. And that is exactly the tactic that they will use this year, because it, again, is their only chance for winning the election. They know they're not going to convince the populace that Republicans are good guardians for the economy, and they know they're not going to change their minds about whether our occupation of Iraq ought to continue indefinitely, or whether the Bush years should continue. And so their only chance for winning is to wrap John McCain in the same packaging, this honor-bound, strong, protective, man of principle whom you like and trust and who is like your neighbor, and to completely twist and distort the Democratic candidate into this sort of freakish, deceitful, reviled figure, so that personality continues to be outcome determinative in elections. And I think that the only way that that process can be reversed is if it stops being a one-way weapon. Democrats have been very reluctant, very unable to engage those attacks directly. And I think the most important premise in reversing it is to realize that these themes are not just heavy. Can Barack Obama bowl because if he can, he's not a regular guy? Does Hillary Clinton have a laugh that that sort of masks this soulless, satanic evil that lurks underneath? Things like that are not only petty. Looking at candidates and looking at their laughs and their bowling scores, I'm taught me to understand how they are. It is petty, but more importantly than that, it's completely deceitful, because the right-wing leaders who are depicted as these sort of swaggering warriors and these men of moral probity and regular values who are in touch with the American heartland are never accurate. And the way to demonstrate that is by taking these candidates and subjecting them to the same standards, to the same personality-based attack that they wield in order to win elections. Not so that the political process is dragged down even further into the muck by having both sides use these really lowly tactics, but as a way of neutralizing those tactics, as a way of making them so that they no longer can be one-sided and therefore effective, and therefore making the political process move into more substantive areas. Because if at the end of the day, it's a permitted that John McCain is built up into this revered man of principle and honor and strength, and the Democratic candidate is a lying, conniving radical who hates America. At the end of the day, no matter what John McCain thinks and what his policy platforms are and what the Democratic candidate's policy platforms are, that obstacle is going to be virtually insurmountable. And so unless John McCain is subjected to the same standards, and the Republicans and the right-wing leadership are subjected to the same standards that Democrats and progressives have been subjected to by the media and by the right, it's going to continue to be one-sided, and there'll be no way to stop it. And my book is really an effort to take these right-wing leaders and put them under that microscope to demonstrate how misleading and deceitful this veneration of their character really is, and to make suggestions and offer proposals for how these media narratives can be undermined and defeated. So that's the book, and those are some of the highlights and ideas in it. And I'm happy to any questions or comments from Kevin. Have a discussion. Yep.
Yeah. One thing is specifically. What would be, is there a model in any state, local, or previous federal campaigns where a Democrat successfully essentially challenged, a Republican hero type as a hypocrite, and it worked, in terms of, oh, you're really a fraud, and you're a weakling and a sissy, and you're pretending to be a strong guy, or something like that, and it worked ever?
Right.
And then B, what do you think about the political brain emotion appeal analysis and that other book that talks about emotions versus issues?
Right. As far as the first question is concerned, I think there's been some reform on the part of how Democratic political campaigns operate, and the recognition that unless they engage things more directly and more forcefully, they'll continue to be at a disadvantage. I think one of the central myths that Democrats have believed for a long time, and this is probably the most toxic myth that they've been told by Democratic strategists and the consulting class, is that the reason that Republicans are perceived as strong is because the hawkishness and war-loving nature of Republicans makes them look strong, and that Democrats look weak when they oppose war or are less hawkish, and that therefore Democrats, the way that they can avoid looking weak is by turning themselves as much as possible into Republicans, by supporting this hawkishness, by supporting wars at least more than they would be otherwise inclined to do, to remove that strength versus weakness mythology off of the table and let elections be decided on economics and other grounds that Democrats perceive are their strong point. The reality is when they do that, exactly the opposite happens. Democrats look weak when they abandon their policies, when they're perceived as trying to move closer to Republicans out of fear of their own positions, when they lack the courage of their convictions. And if you think about the reason why that's the case, that's actually rational. I mean, people who lack the courage of their convictions, by definition, are in fact weak. That is when someone is weak. And so I think that you see candidates more and more coming to that recognition and running their campaigns based on this forceful confrontation of ideas with Republican positions. One of the best examples was Bill Foster, who recently won Denny Hastert's seat by running against a very well-funded Republican candidate. And he made Iraq the centerpiece of opposition, emphatic opposition to Iraq, and compulsory timetables, unconditional timetables for withdrawal, a centerpiece of his campaign, not something that he historically gave some lip service to. And when asked what he thought about FISA and telecom amnesty, at the height of Republican fear-mongering, that unless this bill passed, you're all going to be slaughtered by the terrorists tomorrow, he said emphatically that he believes that his responsibility is to take a strong stand for constitutional liberty, and that what is actually weak in the form of hysteria is to start changing our country in the face of terrorism, so that the idea of who is fearful and weak was really turned around and put into the lap of those who want to continue the war out of fear of what will happen if we leave, or out of who want to dismantle our constitutional framework in order to protect ourselves from the terrorists. And that is a form of weakness, and he appeared strong in a red district by adhering to what Democratic consultants would tell you is the sort of excessively liberal or radical position, and he won in Denny Hastert's district. And Jane was mentioning this event that we had last night. I think that awareness is emerging that fear-driven campaigns are what make you look weak. That's what enable Republicans to propagate these themes. And by really addressing these slurs head-on, I think that's the way that they can be looked at. Yeah.
I'm curious what you think about the current blogger neutrality among progressive bloggers in the primary campaigns, and especially with respect to tactics for media campaigns that might imitate the kind of tactics on the right wing that you did.
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated and touchy question. I actually have been surprised by the extent to which bloggers have abandoned neutrality and have abandoned what I thought would have been the more constructive role of sort of regulating the primary fight to push back against destructive tactics, namely using these right-wing narratives to tear down the personalities of the other candidates. I think Democratic primaries, like any primary, should be very spirited, and they're going to be acrimonious, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And have this election centered on true substantive debate, that probably would have been the most energizing possibility for the Democratic Party and for progressives, and people were excited about this election. And it's turned into this mutually destructive campaign that does mimic right-wing talking points in lots of different ways. And I've been, frankly, a little bit disappointed that bloggers have, I think, sort of ceded their independence and their critical thinking in order to become full-fledged partisans behind one or the other candidate. And as the race has dragged on, I think that's intensified to the point where even bloggers, who I think are on the front lines of pushing back against these right-wing narratives, or ought to be, have decided that whatever hurts the other candidate is actually something that they'll embrace. And I think they're pursuing some short-term gain that has with it a lot of long-term damage. I mean, I think blogs arose as a reaction to the fact that the establishment press and democratic political institutions were failing. And the more the blogs sort of replicate the functions of the establishment press and the Beltway institution, I think the less effective they are. And I think that that's happened a little bit in this election cycle. I mean, if I read some of the blogs that I've read for a long time, it's hard to remember that I'm not reading, like, the Politico or the Drudge Report sometimes, and that's been a little disappointing. So I hope that once the primary is over, blogs will kind of get back to what I think has been the valuable role they've been playing in checking these media narratives and in these right-wing themes. But it's hard to do that once you embrace them for your own short-term gain and then suddenly declare this principled opposition to them again. So I think it's going to be a little tricky. Yeah.
I read your book today about not feeling like you were being hypocritical to take on a Republican directly and point out the places where they were being hypocritical by pursuing their personality. I think the personality-based narrative that has the most effect against Republicans is the idea that they're, for lack of a better term, assholes. They are cold and indifferent to the needs of people, and that they're mean. They're just like it works on George Allen and Robert Dole and a couple of others. I wouldn't necessarily categorize that in the same vein as your post today, in terms of calling them out for their own hypocrisy on the pieces that they're specifically trying to forward. But we've seen a little bit of that gaining traction without effort by the Democratic Party at all, with John McCain and his indifference to the mortgage crisis. Do you think that's a line of attack that the Democrats are interested in pursuing, that it, despite the fact that it might be to some level petty and personality free, it does reflect larger, like, kind of truth about their economic policy for politicians?
Right. It's a good question. I mean, it actually relates to the second part of this question over here that I forgot to answer, which is the idea that we need that political messaging works only if there's a substantial component of it that triggers emotional response, because no human being, even the most rational among us, really will think first and foremost rationally. And so that if you're presented with a candidate who's triggering strong emotional responses and another one who's offering 10-point policy positions that appeal to you from a sort of bureaucratic or technocratic perspective, the emotional responses are going to overwhelm the more rational when it comes time to making choices. So, you know, I think that, yeah, there are, and so what I mean when I say that these sorts of emotional and more visceral arguments need to be made is, I don't necessarily mean that I think we should replicate the worst excesses of the right. To say that there's an emotional appeal that should be made, you know, very noble political messages have been delivered that have resonated emotionally. I mean, Martin Luther King would inspire a huge crowd by triggering all kinds of strong emotional responses, but it also was the case that he was speaking truthfully and in a noble way and in a substantive way. And so when I say that I think these Republican themes need to be engaged directly, I don't mean that we should be deceitful or that we should smear people when there's no factual basis. What I mean is that when there are character mythologies presented about John McCain that are false, I think that they need to be pointed out and exposed as false, rather than let them linger on the grounds that we're going to rise above these personality attacks. And I think you're right, economic issues are going to be are going to resonate a lot more than they probably have in 2004 and certainly 2002 and before that. But I also think that at the end of the day, if these character issues aren't undermined, that it's not really going to matter that the Democrats have a better health care plan and are perceived as being better in terms of providing economic security. And I actually saw a poll a couple days ago that was pretty amazing, where they asked who would be a better steward for the economy, John McCain or Barack Obama / Hillary Clinton. And even on economic issues, this poll said that Americans think John McCain would be a better steward for the economy. I don't even think John McCain would say that. that's astonishing. And yet, I think the reason is that once, you know, people perceive McCain as an honorable man of principle, then this idea that, well, he's indifferent to the suffering of your children or whether you have economic insecurity is a very hard case to make, because his character is already established as something that people trust. And that's why I think it's so dangerous to allow that those themes to go unchallenged. Yep. Good point. I mean, the idea of shifting strategies in order to attack the right on the same playing field that they attack is not mutually exclusive with influencing media behavior and changing media conduct. In fact, they're complementary. And when I say that these things need to be done, these issues need to be raised, these arguments need to be advanced, implicit within that is that strategies need to be deployed in order to make sure that those messages get across to the media. And one of the reasons why I spend as much time as I do singling out individual reporters for condemnation or examining specific articles or biases from news organizations, because I think that shame is a really good tactic for changing the conduct of specific journalists. And I think that journalists have become increasingly self-conscious of the fact that they're perceived as being in the tank for McCain, or reverent of him, or worshipful of him, and uncritical of his flaws. And so one of the tactics for ensuring that this messaging is heard more loudly is to continue to pressure the media in order to be more balanced. It's also to develop better strategies to have Democrats and progressives who are heard more and listened to more be more forceful in their advocacy. It's just a fact of life that the establishment press is an obstacle for Democratic candidates to win national elections, and that they are favorable to the right and to the Republican candidates. That is a fact of life. And so the question is not, isn't it too bad that we can't do anything about that, or how can we circumvent it? The question then becomes, how can those obstacles be overcome? And I think that the media can be moved a lot more than they have been thus far in order to convey these messages. Strategies need to be formulated for that. The right messages need to be deployed. But you're absolutely right. Nothing can work. And it's why I spend a lot of time in my book addressing the role that the media plays in disseminating these themes, until there's a strategy for disseminating these messages through the media. And the fact that it hasn't worked thus far, in my view, doesn't mean that it can't work or it inevitably will fail. It just means the right strategy and the right messaging haven't been developed. And I think that's really the central question, is figuring out how to change that. Yeah.
Two things. One is in 2000... Oh, was it me?
No, go ahead.
Okay, sorry.
That's all right.
2004, the great Democratic pushback was supposed to be on the National Guard, the Air National Guard, which it didn't show up. And that was supposed to herald this, you know, the Democrats now can play hardball. And it didn't seem to go anywhere. I don't know if it died simply because the traditional media didn't. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then it seemed to putter out. And then no further attempts like that were made. So that was one question, was just as to why those efforts didn't go, even for that matter, why didn't we go after that story in 2000, when it might have made a lot more of a difference. And the second question is, what is anything to be learned from the 1992 election, where Clinton, Bill Clinton, was, you know, he smoked pot, he was an adulterer, all these, you know, everything, they took everything at him, he still won by, you know, what was it, 5 points, 6 points? So, I mean, is there any lessons to be learned from that campaign, or was it just that everyone was so upset with the incumbent? I mean, it's an incumbency question, that everyone was, that the incumbent was explicitly tied to all the failed policies. But is there any lessons to be learned from the 92 election? So those are kind of my two.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take the first one.
I'll take the first one first, which is, you know, I think that the example that, that you raised is actually a good example illustrating what I was talking about, which is, you know, the reason why the National Guard story never went anywhere is because the right successfully pressured and shamed the media out of reporting that story through the documents and through the allegations of fraud, to the point where they were actually, the media was actually afraid to report on anything that had anything to do with that because they knew the tidal wave of criticism, of bias, of all sorts of allegations were going to be directed at them. And editors and producers and journalists are affected by behavior like that. And so again, in an ideal world, media coverage wouldn't be determined by those kind of pressure campaigns. In the world in which we live, there are really only two choices. To let the right wield that weapon unilaterally, and therefore shape coverage in exactly the way that you're talking about, to cause the stories to be concealed, or to develop our own strategies to serve as a counterweight and to push back against that and to make those weapons much more balanced. And I think that's one of the critical challenges. I mean, I think you can blame a lot of the failures on the part of the media, on the media, on the media culture, on the right's mastery, but a lot of the failure has to be blamed as well on the unwillingness or the inability thus far for methods to be developed to offset that and serve as a counterweight. I mean, these are human systems, and like any other human system, they can be changed and altered and amended and torn down and replaced, and if they're not being any of those things, it's because the right ways haven't been figured out yet or because there hasn't been a will to do so. And I think there has been a lot of liberal squeamishness about engaging in some of these tactics, but we're above those sorts of things. And we prefer to talk only about policy and substance. And, you know, we're going to, by rising above it, show that we're better. And I think it's pretty clear that fails. And so, you know, unfortunate though that may be, I think that's a political reality. And the second part,
just 92.
Yeah, I think that's a really complicated question. Why Bill Clinton was sort of an aberration and an exception, why he was able to achieve political success. I mean, he was certainly subjected to all of these kind of personality attacks. I mean, 1992 was a bit aberrational because he had three candidates. And whether it was just a Republican versus Democrat, more traditional election, what the outcome would have been, I think, is uncertain. 1996, you know, I think he ran against a fairly weak candidate who actually wasn't very comfortable with these kind of attacks. The economy was good. So I don't say that these, and I think that actually the Clinton machine was slightly more aggressive about confronting these themes than Democrats generally are. And so I don't say that these obstacles are entirely insurmountable. Under the perfect circumstances, I mean, Democrats can win elections. They just won in 2006. But it shouldn't take perfect circumstances for victory to be possible. It should be a much more even playing field. And so yeah, there are some lessons to draw from 1992 and 1996, but if you look back over the last 30 years, it seems more aberrational than anything else. Yeah?
Two-part question. First one, it sounds like you're almost arguing for the establishment of a kind of deterrence, where if the right goes for certain personality-based attacks, we attack them for using a personality-based attack, for saying you don't want to go to the issue, you don't want to, you know, you want to talk about little stuff. Why are you blushing now that I'm bringing up personality-based things that you've done, despite the fact that, you know, irrespective of what I've done? That's the first part. The other question is, and I'm wondering, because I know you've referenced Ultima, I believe, how that plays into authoritarianism. Is it just because it's a good cheap lever for them to use, or is that something deeper in the authoritarian personality?
As far as the first question is concerned, sorry, Ben, can you just reference me what yeah. the first, sorry.
Is, so you're, so to summarize, you're arguing for a kind of a deterrence way.
Right, okay, thing. Yeah, that's exactly the model that I think works. And, you know, I think the analogy that I would use is if one country obtains a very potent weapon, the rival countries want to obtain the same weapon, not so that they can both use it, but precisely so to ensure that neither will. And I think that's exactly right. I mean, if, you know, the reason why Republicans think that this strategy works is because if John McCain can be built up into this superb icon of all virtue, and the Democratic candidate can be torn down into this grotesque figure of deceit and elitism, then they think that they're going to win. And they're probably right about that. At the same time, if John McCain were going to be subjected to these same tactics and be torn down to the same level that the Democratic candidate would, then that tactic would no longer be effective. It will have been neutralized. And the playing field necessarily will shift in terms of what determines the outcome of elections. And I think that's really why, as distasteful as it might be, the only two choices that there are to allow these weapons to be one-sided or to start deploying them with equal efficacy to ensure that they're neutralized. So, you know, I think it's not a fun thing, but I think that, you know, at the end of the day, it's the only thing that can really work. Yep.
I just have a quick question. It seems like a lot of the comments have been very defensive. And I tell the old adage, the best defense is a good offense. So could you explain how the Democrats and progressives could use it from an offensive perspective as opposed to a defensive perspective? Because I would hate to be reactionary. I'd rather be proactive.
I think that's really the heart of the whole problem. I know, for me, a lot of my perceptions come from when I first began politically writing just a couple of years ago. One of the very first topics that I really became intensely interested in was the revelation that the president had been breaking the law by spying on Americans without warrants. And to me, the most amazing thing about that was the clarity of the corruption. I mean, we just have laws that really do say that is a felony for any political official to eavesdrop on American citizens and our communications inside the United States without warrant. And the New York Times revealed that the president was doing exactly that which the law says is a felony. And the president, when he got caught, came out and said, you know what, I have been doing that, and I'm glad I did it, and I'm going to continue to do it. And I thought, in my naivete at the time, that this was going to be the almost the Democrats, even if they did everything wrong as they normally do, would almost be unable to avoid being successful here. That this is going to be the moment of reckoning for the Bush administration because they got caught committing felonies out in the open that are very substantive felonies. And to my amazement, although I wouldn't be amazed by it now, but I was then, I watched one Democrat after the next, even, you know, Democrats from super blue states, safe seats, go on to Meet the Press and Face the Nation and all those shows. And I remember watching and being all excited that there was going to be this great case being made and the Americans were going to, public was going to wake up and see how contemptuous the Bush administration was of our constitutional framework and the rule of law finally. They would start assuring the host that Democrats wanted to fight terrorism as well, and that Democrats also believe in strong national defense, and that Democrats thought it was really important to listen in on terrorists whenever they're calling to hear what Osama bin Laden was saying. And then when they finally got around to actually addressing the issue after offering up all those apologies and all of those defensive assurances of their own willingness to stand firm in national security, which wasn't actually, they weren't on being accused of anything, they nonetheless felt obligated to defend themselves. Once they got around to the issue, none of them would say, the Bush administration is breaking the law. They're committing felonies. This needs to be investigated and prosecuted because we are a nation of laws and not men. And there is no affirmative case being made. The most that they would say is things like, well, this seems like they might have circumvented the statute and they probably should, you know, come and talk to us and figure out how we can bring this within. And so, you know, even as I listened to it, I almost became unpersuaded that anything wrongdoing had been happening. And I was writing about this every day. And so I know that no American who was watching that would ever in a million years conclude that this was anything serious. And worse than that, you would actually conclude that the Democrats have the weaker argument because why else would they be so tentative and apologetic about what it is they were saying unless what they were saying was wrong and invalid? The Republicans would go on and with the straightest possible face be very boastful of what they had done and insist that what they had done right. And if you were watching this, you would get the sense that they were on the side of right. And it's that defensiveness and that apology and that unwillingness to stand firm in their convictions that really is the heart of all of these problems, because if one side won't defend their own positions and the other side will, it's just natural to conclude that the side that's proud of their position has the right perspective, or at the very least are people of principle, and the side that is afraid of their own position are sort of cowardly and weak. Yes. Yeah.
What do you think in the last question is best at doing this, dealing with these issues, and what was our greatest missed opportunity?
In the last cycle, when?
Oh, six.
I think, and a couple of people have discussed this, that it's difficult to take local and even state elections and translate them into national elections because the dynamic is so different, the themes are so different. At the same time, you know, again, I would point to some of the best victories in the Senate, say John Tester or Jim Webb, people who were incredibly self-confident about their positions. I mean, you know, Tester ran on a platform not of modifying the Patriot Act in order to get rid of some of its worst excesses, but of abolishing the Patriot Act altogether. And nobody was going to accuse him of being weak on the bill. Why not? Because he was crystal clear about the rationale behind that position and beyond unapologetic about it. I think Jim Webb also, and he won in a red state, and Jim Webb also in a red state, was an outspoken opponent of the Iraq War. I mean, for reasons that are sort of unique to him, he never felt defensive about justifying his position or assuring particular voters that he nonetheless was a patriot or strong in national security. I mean, he didn't need to for reasons unique to him, but also because just as a candidate, he too was very convicted and unapologetic about the type of issues that he had. And he didn't listen to Democratic strategists. He didn't take a mealy-mouthed approach to the war. Tester didn't take a mealy-mouthed approach to the Patriot Act. And I think those candidates were much more admirable and much stronger in the eye and much more trustworthy as a result in the eyes of their voters than had they listened to strategists who told them, look, you're in a red state and you need to modify your position. So those, I think, are just a couple of examples that I think exemplify the kind of dynamic I'm describing.
Did you see any real missed opportunities?
I haven't really thought too much about how the themes apply to Democratic Senate races that were lost. I'd have to go back and kind of think about some of the close elections that Democrats lost. In general, I think the Democrats collectively are perceived as weak for these reasons, and I think it seeps down to even some of these races where it may not be applicable to individual candidates. Just one more, and then we'll...
It sort of came up in the debate as I was listening to it, but it's something I've thought for a long time. I strongly believe that the criminality of the Bush administration, this Bush administration, the 8 years, was enabled by Clinton, and by Clinton looking, basically wiping his hands of criminality in Reagan-Bush one. And it ties in with this perception of sort of either wanting to be, you know, not wanting to be seen as weak, you know, we're doing investigations, or wanting to create a perception of like, well, bygones, we're above this, we're not going to look at it. Do you think that Obama or Clinton will actually investigate the criminality of this current administration profoundly? And if they don't, do you think it will enable the criminality of the Jeb Bush administration or whatever comes up?
I actually would go back further in time to the pardon of Richard Nixon by Gerald Ford, which is when the whole idea arose that whenever our high government officials commit felonies, it's really important to forgive them and immunize them from conduct so that we can all join together and move on. And that was, the consensus of the political class. I mean, when Gerald Ford died, he was celebrated for this great act of pardoning a felonious president, because that's what enabled the country to move beyond. And I don't think felonies are something that we ought to want to move beyond. There are things that ought to be punished if we're going to be a country that lives under the rule of law. So I think that was sort of the first instance when this idea took root. And I think you're right that Clinton got into office and had thought that investigating those crimes, Iran-Contra and other crimes, would impede his ability to pursue his agenda, that he thought, although he was disabused of this fairly quickly, that he was going to be a president who could overcome partisan differences and govern in this climate of unity, and that pursuing those prior crimes would be something that would impede that. And I think you're right that the way in which the entire Reagan and Bush administration was able to get away with all sorts of crimes further it bolstered the idea that our political officials at the highest levels are not actually subjected to the rule of law, that they can violate the law with impunity. Obviously, this administration took that lesson to heart, and to as far as an extent as one could have imagined.